Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Good Radio Network, radio that does a world of good. This isn't your average talk radio show. We're blasting away the old tried and not so true mold. Instead, TGRN turns talk into action. And action leads to doing positive things for people, our environment, and even the animals.
Well, I'm only one person. What can I do?
A lot. Join host Frankie Picasso while she turns talk into doing and gets results. This is the Good Radio Network. Yes, you can do it if you try, even if you're just a regular guy. Now, here's your host, Frankie Picasso.
Well, good day and welcome to you. This is Frankie, I can't even say my own name today, Frankie Picasso, and I'm with the Good Radio Network. It is officially spring here in the Great White North, and even though this morning there were white pellets falling from the sky, Mother Nature didn't get the memo. There's no sunshine outside here, but I am filled with sunshine and warmth inside because yesterday was the 25th of Remember for March, and a delivery of 20 little owies went to Northridge Hospital. So a big shout out and thank you to the Kiwanis Club of Thousand Oaks for sending those off to the kids there. That was amazing. And if you remember last month, together, we all sent 20 large Owie Bow Owie comfort companions to Duke University Medical Center in North Carolina to all the children who were hospitalized there. And each of them received their gift of comfort. And if you'd like, you can see a few of the photos on the goodradionetwork.com website. Or if you go to iloveowie.org, you can see them there as well. Because remember, not everyone gets the 25th of December. And this, I dare say, is something that my guest today is well aware of as well, because she works in active war zones around the world. Nikki Waits is the Deputy Director for War Child Canada, and she's in charge of international programs for this organization, providing support to those offering programs in communities where war and conflicts have created serious problems for children. She works in places like Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, South Sudan, and Uganda. War Child works in these six countries offering programs for education, livelihood, and justice, all through a child-focused lens. Nikki's been working in the nonprofit world for over 14 years. She has a BA in communications and a Master of Science in Rural Extension Studies from the University of Guelph, examining the role of media and communication in international aid and development, something I'm sure she puts to good practice. In fact, her thesis work was published in part by the United Nations Development Program as part of their Communication for Empowerment initiative. She is as bright as she is beautiful, and you can see her picture on our website. And prior to War Child Canada, she worked as the International Program Director of Journalists for Human Rights, a nonprofit that focused on rebuilding media environments in post-conflict African countries. She's on the first media assessment mission to Liberia, and she worked with the International Criminal Court in the Democratic Republic of the Congo to develop a program to train journalists on how to report on ICC proceedings. She also led the expansion of Journalists for Human Rights from 5 to 16 countries of operation. Very impressive. Welcome, Nikki.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Look at all the stuff you've done, and you look like you're 20.
That is quite the intro, and thank you for that.
Yeah, that's amazing. Listen, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with War Child. I think it's a good story.
Yeah, so I've been at War Child for about 3.5 years now. But, you know, as you mentioned, I've been in the nonprofit world for quite a long time. And sort of it was just a natural progression for me. I mean, I've always been interested in international aid and development. And as you mentioned, you know, spent quite a bit of time at Journalists for Human Rights working to rebuild media communities in post-conflict countries and, you know, went from there to health and development. But was really always interested more in sort of the conflict in war affected countries and the impact that was having on children, on their mothers, on their families. And so when the opportunity at War Child came up, I really just jumped at it. And it's been an amazing time to be here. The organization is going through a lot of growth. And, you know, unfortunately, in today's world, the programming that we do is more needed than ever. You know, and I say unfortunately because, you know, we envision a world where we're not needed, where there are no children affected by war. And so, yeah, so I've been here for 3.5 years, and we're expanding and growing and looking at new countries of operation and where it's the best fit for us.
That's amazing. I saw that you posted last week on your blog that you were in the South Sudan, and you wrote about the 89 boys who were taken and kidnapped from a school there, so reminiscent of the girls who were kidnapped. They were studying their exams, you said, and even some of the kids in the community in the Upper Nile State were grabbed as well. All indications were that they were forcibly recruited into armed militia. How often do you see things like that?
Yeah, I think as far as how often we see it versus how often it happens, you know, it's probably a question for debate. I think what caught the community off guard with this was that this situation in particular did get a lot of international attention, which I think, you know, when they take children, they don't, in, you know, more remote areas, whoever does it doesn't think it's necessarily going to get international attention. And for that reason, they think they're going to get away with it. And so fortunately, in this case, they were able to secure the release of the children, and they're all back, and they're all back in time to finish their government exams, which is really important because you need to finish that to go on to your next year of schooling. And when children miss out on that, we do see a lot of, you know, higher dropout rates. And so, between that and, as you mentioned, the situation in northern Nigeria with Boko Haram, like, unfortunately, it is becoming increasingly common with the armed conflicts for groups to forcibly recruit children. But I do think the extent at which it happens versus how we hear about it, how often we hear about it, I think there's probably a very large discrepancy there.
No, I said that you're hands on the ground because you've been to so many countries with this organization and the other organizations that you worked with. How safe do you feel when you travel there?
Yeah, I mean, it's
or how much danger are you in, should I say, for your mother? Your mom might be listening.
Yeah. Hopefully my mom's not listening.
Exactly.
You know, as far as the feeling of security, I think that's a very individual thing. And you need to do this line of work is a very individual decision as well. War Child as an organization has very stringent safety and security policies and procedures, as one would expect for all of our staff. And so as far as feeling as secure as I'm going to feel in these environments, I feel secure. But in comparison to that, you're in Afghanistan or you're in South Sudan or, you know, these countries that are just naturally volatile. So you feel as safe as you can feel given the situation, but it's only natural to sort of have that heightened sense of awareness of what's going on around you, of security, of, you know, the very, you know, there's always a chance you're just going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and that kind of thing. But that's where you really just trust in, you know, we have amazing local teams and local security focal points. And as I said, you know, very stringent safety and security policies and procedures that we follow that include curfews and where to go when and who can go with you and all of this kind of stuff. So we really do put safety as the top priority for everyone.
Okay, great. I just want to mention one thing. There's a couple of calls coming from your office, and I don't know if they're people who want to speak or just listen. Do you have any idea?
I have no idea.
Well, I might bring one on and let's just see what happens.
Sure,
or maybe
we'll see who it is.
Hello there. Are you listening in? Oh, they all hung up.
Oh,
there we go. Okay, maybe they were just a fluke of a fluke. That's kind of strange. Anyway,
it could be a phone system. Sorry about that.
No, I don't care. That's good, fine with me. I thought maybe they want to listen or talk. Who knows? The education, War Child really stresses that education is a key to helping, you know, these children regain their childhood. And how does that work? Why is that so important?
As far as education is so key to ensure that you, you know, really break the cycle of violence and break the cycle of poverty that we see in a lot of these countries. And so we really look at it from a multifaceted approach of formal education, informal education, you know, all of the approaches to ensure that children are able to either keep up with their education or catch up with their education, and that all of their education is in a very safe and child-friendly environment. So, for example, in Darfur, we're one of the largest providers of accelerated learning. And accelerated learning is a condensed curriculum that allows children to catch up on multiple years of education in about 8 or 9 months. So it means that children who've been out of school for a while can catch up on their education, write a government-approved exam at the end of it, and go back into the formal schooling system. Because what we see in a lot of these countries is, you know, a few months out of school, and that's enough for the child, unfortunately, to drop out because they've fallen so far behind, they're not able to complete the government exam. exam. You know, there might not be a school there for them to go back to in some cases if it's been destroyed or, you know, people have moved into it. And so it's really important to do whatever you can to make sure that children can keep up with their education. And we're seeing that a lot in Jordan now as well with Syrian refugee children of, you know, these children who've been out of school for 3 and 4 years, and how do you help them keep up with education and ensure that when they do go back to Syria, they'll be able to go back into the Syrian education system. So, you know, Jordan's a country that we're currently expanding to and looking at those education approaches and how we help Syrian children keep up with the Jordanian curriculum, which is different, you know, to their curriculum, and make sure that they're able to keep up in that education system so we don't end up with a lost generation.
So important. I read that one of the I'm sure many of your schools are you know, the amount of children coming in is so much larger than the actual physical brick and mortar building can hold. So are people helping? Are they building like portables or tents or things like that? How can we help? How can we help War Child?
Yeah, so I mean, War Child in the past, we have physically built schools. We've built about 38 schools in the Congo in the east in a conflict-affected zone where a lot of the schools were just destroyed or crumbling because of the conflict. And then we're working in a place in South Sudan right now in Upper Nile State where one of the schools, not one that we built, but one of the only existing schools in the area has 3,000 children and 8 teachers.
Wow.
And so on a double shift system, they're looking at, I think it was about 200 to 300 children per classroom, which I mean, physically,
wow,
as you said, like you can't physically fit it. So we did build another temporary school in that location. But we are looking at what else we can do to help the community build more classrooms there. And same thing in a separate location in South Sudan, because South Sudan has a lot of displaced persons right now because of the conflict. You know, they're in locations that don't necessarily have schools. And so we've built these temporary schools, but we're just exceeding capacity that we have, and so we keep getting asked to build more schools,
right.
And so it's just a matter of physically finding the space, because in some cases, you know, we're working in displaced persons camps and there's not physically the space to put more classrooms, so you're a little bit stuck on that. But then where there is a space, it's not, you know, just as simple as building a school. You need to outfit it with all the furniture, with textbooks, with trained teachers, with latrines, with water points, you know, with everything that children need to make sure that they're learning in a safe environment and that they're receiving,
right,
a quality education.
And so I think I read some statistics, and you can help me with that, that because I can't remember if it was in Syria or if it was in Sudan, but something about that the children had taken some exams and that they had scored higher than, like, children in non-conflict areas or something. Am I getting that right?
I think that was from Sudan, from Darfur. Yeah, we had done a distribution of textbooks there. So in most classrooms in West Darfur where we are, there's one textbook for the entire class and the teacher has it. Mm-hmm. And so where, you know, kids in Canada or the U.S., they have all their textbooks for all the different subjects.
Sure.
There's one textbook for, say, 70 students. And so if you don't take notes during a lecture while the teacher is using that textbook, you don't have anything to study off of. And so we had done a distribution of class sets of textbooks, so entire classrooms, so every student had their own textbook. And the children in those classrooms, they had, and it's on our website, I might have this not quite right, but they scored 8th in all of West Darfur on their government exams, and had increased the, I don't remember the percentage, but had increased the percentage of students who passed their exams as well, compared to previous years when they didn't have the class set of textbooks, for the simple reason that the students had something to study off of, where in the
right
past they hadn't. And, you know, how do you study
right
for an exam when you don't have the material that is based on?
And are these classrooms, are they like grade 1 through, like, I don't know, I'm sure they have it set up differently, but for us in North America, grade 1 through 12, are they like a one-room schoolhouse? Is it, or are you doing kinder and do you separate them?
Yeah, it really varies per country. As you said, I mean, each country has their own sort of grading system and age
sure
ranges. For our accelerated learning, there's groupings because, you know, you might have a child who dropped out of school at age 8 and a child who dropped out of school at age you know, 15, but they could be at the same grade level at this point. And so the accelerated curriculum is done based on sort of assessments on where the child is at and where they're going to go back into in the formal schooling system. For that textbook example, I think that was for a class of students who were around 13 or 14 years of age who were going into secondary level. And that's just such a critical point in all of the countries that we work in, because you'll see a big difference in enrollment between what we would classify as elementary and high school, in that there's quite a significant dropout. You know, a lot of families just say, all right, the child's completed elementary education, we need them to come work now, you know, or we can't afford to send them to secondary, and particularly for girls, there's a big discrepancy on girls who are able to complete primary and who then go on to secondary. So it's really critical to ensure that there's a successful transition there.
Like, I know that I've worked with different orphanages through the years in Africa, and the cost of schooling is so prohibitive. Like, why is it so expensive to send children to school there?
You know, it's a good question, and it's a question that, you know, also needs to be addressed a little country by country. There are a lot of countries that, you know, theoretically on paper have free primary education, but then you have everything that's on top of that, you know, the cost of the uniform, the cost of the school books, the cost of a pencil, proper shoes for the child, like all of this kind of stuff that you need to give a child who goes to school. And so even those fees, those what we might consider, you know, a comparatively small cost for a couple notebooks and pencils can be prohibitive, you know, and so the child's family might not even have the money for those. But it's also the opportunity cost. A family might say, you know, we can send the child to school, but if we send them to work, we're going to make money, you know, however little that money might be. And so it's not just the hard cost of sending the child to school, it's, you know, families looking at that opportunity cost as well, unfortunately, and having to make those really difficult decisions. And in a lot of cases, it's, you know, not that families don't want to send the child to school, it's they can't afford for the family to not have the child working. And so that's where War Child also does a lot of livelihoods programming with families to increase household income, to ensure that they have the resources that they need as a family to not only, you know, support the family, but to make sure that those children are able to go to school.
And are they targeted, are the kids targeted, you know, into what we might call training programs, or are you looking, hoping that somebody will go to university?
So once they're, you know, of legal age, say in most countries is about 18, we do provide a lot of vocational training programs for youth who aren't able to go to university, which because of the areas we work in is pretty much the vast majority of those who we work with, unfortunately. You know, and where they do want to go to university, we provide as much support and all of that as we can. But our vocational training programs are geared to youth who want to go on into a training program and maybe can't, you know, afford that training program, or it might not be available where they are. And so we look at sort of the local market and what's needed, because you don't want to train 200 people in tailoring if, you know, the local market needs two new tailors. So we look at what the local market needs and what the demand is, and then provide training based on that. So it could be, you know, and then youth can choose the training program they want to go into. But we recently did a graduation for youth in South Sudan, actually. We'd run a vocational training program, and they were trained in hairdressing, mechanics, driving, I'm forgetting a couple of them here, and food processing and a couple others as well, and then provided with small startup kits to go on and start their own businesses, so that not only are they receiving the training, but they have the materials that they need to start their own business and start earning an income almost right away.
I love that. I think that's just so amazing that you guys are doing that. How has compassion fatigue affected War Child? Do you find that, are you getting money from individual donors? I know that you put on some big concerts with some big names. Is that where the money comes from, or how are you getting financed?
Yeah, I mean, we have really great donors, and we're getting more donors almost every day who are just really supportive of the cause and really interested in the work that we're doing. And then we do have grants as well from government agencies, from UN agencies, for the work in all of the countries that we're in as well.
I know that you try to use local people as much as you can, I think. Do you have many volunteers, though, from North America who want to help teach people who maybe retired, things like that?
Yeah, we do get inquiries. We're not a volunteer sending agency, as some agencies are, and so we actually don't send volunteers overseas. all of our staff, our national staff, are from the countries in which we operate and from the communities in which we're implementing as well. So for example, you know, in the states that we work in South Sudan, our staff are from those states. So not only are they South Sudanese, but they're from the community in which we're working. So they have really strong ties to the community and are able to, you know, really interact with the community because it's where they grew up. And so
right.
That's true of all of the countries that we're in. And so while we appreciate that there is a role for international volunteers, it's not part of our mandate as an agency.
Right, because you're really trying to hand everything off. You're trying to okay, we've got you to where you need to go. You know how to do it now and take it over. We're gone.
Yeah, no, very much that's what we want. We work through a lot of local partner agencies as well. So sort of local nonprofits in the countries that we're in to implement our programming and to build their capacity. So, you know, working with a local nonprofit in the Democratic Republic of the Congo to implement a project, but at the same time, you know, training them on financial management and grant writing and human resource management and monitoring and evaluation and all of these things that you need to run a successful nonprofit so that by the end of our time with them, not only can they keep working on, you know, the work we've been doing with them, but they can design and implement and fund their own programming as well without that level of external support there.
That's amazing. Really teaching them how to fish.
Yeah.
I read something I found very interesting. Something about functional literacy and numeracy in Afghanistan that you paired this with extensive mail outreach, and now the mullahs in Jalalabad were asking War Child Canada to expand programming and educate more women. Now that has to be a real coup.
Yeah, it was. So we've worked in Afghanistan for, gosh, I think just over 10 years now. And most of the programming until recently was focused on women's economic development. And so we were doing education with women who, you know, in large part because of the Taliban, hadn't
right.
had a chance for that formal education. And so it was that functional literacy and numeracy with them, but then vocational training, business skills training, microfinance, business startup support, and ongoing mentoring. So that from the start of the program, these women who couldn't, you know, read beyond a few basic words or count money, we're running their own businesses. And that's a very long-term change to look at. And we have a long-term, you know, strategy for Afghanistan. But there's no way of doing any work with women in Afghanistan and with some of the other countries we're in without having that support of, you know, male family members and male community leaders. And so we spent a lot of time working with men in the communities on, you know, approaches that they agreed with and helping, getting them to design the project with us and, you know, talking to them about women's rights and their rights and what they wanted out of this program. And it was really that extensive outreach and then the work with women and everybody, the men and women, seeing that we were in Afghanistan for a long time and that we weren't going to be going anywhere, that really got that community buy-in to the extent where the mullahs did come in Jalalabad and say, you know, can you expand this program? The women you've reached are great, but they're just a drop in the bucket of the women who need this support.
Yeah, it must be. I can't just imagine how these women and how it feels for them to be able to learn and you know, go and read a sign and it just must be so freeing. I can just imagine the
yeah.
joy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the women that I talked to on one of my trips there, you know, we said, can you go to the market by yourself now? Because, you know, if you can't count out money and count out change, you really
right.
can't go to the market by yourself. And so we said, you know, can you go to the market by yourself now and do the shopping by yourself? And this one woman said, of course we can. We're just like men. It doesn't matter that we don't have beards. and I thought that was just such a great comment. You know, and we have women running businesses who are now employing 50 people. You know, and again, these are women who, before this intervention, couldn't, you know, count out basic change or, you know, really didn't have the capacity to do a lot of this and are now employing 50 people, and some of them are men. And so it's been a really great success story there, and we just keep building on that work in Afghanistan.
Hear this all the time. It's just absolutely amazing. Like Thrive talks about it. You just, you know, if you help a woman, you help a country. You know, you really do. They are really amazing at business and finding ways to run a business and grow and feed their families and give back to that community. It's not just for them. You know, they have the heart, I think, to make it all work. I think it's great.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think part of it with the women, though, is just in some of the programming, and this is, you know, coming back to the male outreach component, you can't leave men out of the equation. And I think we've learned as an international development community that, yes, invest in women, but not to the expense of leaving men out. And so that's where I think it's been really important, and part of our success has been involving men in it. You know, and in some cases, male family members are running the businesses with the women. You know, we did have that extensive outreach with the men. So, well, yes, investing with women, but men have to be a key part of the equation as well.
Now, this I find just absolutely so exciting. The idea that, you know, women and children are victims of severe human rights violation, especially sexual violence in times of war, that War Child Canada actually registered a business illegal. They became a legal business, you know, operating legally.
Yeah, we're a law firm.
You're a law firm in Uganda. Like, how exciting is
and
that?
And Afghanistan.
And Afghanistan. Wow. And are actually redressing the cases of these women and children survivors. How amazing is that?
Yeah, no, we've been a registered law firm in Uganda for a number of years, and more recently in Afghanistan. And it is so that we can, you know, directly take some of these cases to court. For the most part in Uganda, we're able to solve non-criminal cases through alternative dispute resolution, which is a form of mediation. You know, you have a court case that could take 2 or 3 years to get to court, and people want resolution faster than that. So you can do this alternative dispute resolution and come to a solution outside of the formal court system where it's not a criminal case. So that's really helped in a lot of the cases as well. And then we're able to take that model and adapt it to Afghanistan to, again, build on the work that we had been doing with the women around their economic rights and all of that, and really help them to start realizing some of the legal rights that they do have.
So you're really changing a culture, though, as you do this, aren't you? It's so ingrained just to for men, especially in those countries, to look on women as property or to look on women as second class. And so the work that you are doing with the justice community, with judges and people, you know, in power, how are you helping to change their thoughts and their views on that what you're doing is right. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think in some cases it's not necessarily changing thoughts and views, it's helping them to realize what is in their country's constitution or what is in some treaties that their country has ratified. Because a lot of these countries, if you look at what they have on paper, you know, or what the country has signed on to, you know, it's there. You know, Afghanistan has made strides in violence against women and, you know, policies and laws around that. There's a lot in the Congo as well. You know, they've signed on to the Maputo Protocol, like all of these different documents. So in a lot of cases, the paper is there, and I say paper because, you know, it all looks great on paper.
Sure.
And so, you know, we operate within that context of saying, you know, look at what's in your country's constitution. Women and men have the right to this, this, and this. So this is how, you know, within your legal system, you are able to help enforce that as a police officer, as a lawyer, as a judge, as a community leader, what have you. So it's really just using the legal instruments that are there and doing the training based on that.
So there's nothing in their legal work or constitution that says stoning is okay?
In some countries, there's definitely things within, you know, some of the constitution or other documents that they've signed on to that might be contradictory to each other. You're
right.
Also dealing with, you know, what's happening practically through traditional or informal justice systems versus the formal justice system. But the starting point is always, you know, what's in the constitution that's positive for men and women that we can look at. I mean, we're not an advocacy organization insofar as looking at things in the constitution that we might not agree with and saying, hey, you should change that. There are great organizations out there that focus on that. So we really focus on what's there and then looking at if there is that gap in the informal justice system and the formal justice system and saying, you know, what is this gap? How can we address it? And then it is through things like alternative dispute resolution that we can bring together, you know, the parties who are at conflict with each other and maybe some community leaders and come to an agreement that's good for all parties.
Gina's in the chat room saying, help a woman, help a country. She liked that as a title for a book. And she wants to know, is anybody writing the stories of the women, you know, or these women write their own stories, talking about the worst circumstances and motivating other people or other women in their country to see that anything is possible?
Well, the founder of War Child did write a book, Samantha Nutch wrote a book called Damnations, that is available, that I would encourage everyone to read. It's a little bit more broad than just the stories of the women. Certainly some of the stories of the women are in there, but it's more sort of her experience in the international community and what's going on right now with aid and development. It's a very interesting read. As far as the stories of these women...
Damnations,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so great read. Would encourage everyone to go out and get a copy. As far as these women's stories in particular that I'm telling, they're not in a book yet. It's maybe something that we would look at as an organization moving forward, but there's definitely a lot of good books out there that aren't War Child related on what's going on with women and children in developing countries, some of the success stories. We do put a lot of this on our blog as well at warchild.ca, so a lot of the stories are up there as well.
Yeah, I mean, you, as a journalist, you write about, you know, the things that you see. You're a really great writer, by the way. And,
oh, thanks.
And I guess every country has its own, set of circumstances that it needs more than others. So can you tell us a couple of stories, things that you've seen along the way that really impressed you about humanity and just how we thrive from children to women, maybe?
Yeah, I think definitely working with the women in Afghanistan has been great. I mean, just seeing their progress and where they're at now. And, another time I was in Afghanistan meeting with the women and I said, the program was funded by the Canadian government. And I said, I'm going to go back to Ottawa and I'm going to meet with the Canadian government and tell them what's going on with this program and what we need and, where it's at and all this. And I said, what do you want me to tell them? And this one woman, she said, just put me on the phone with them and I'll tell them everything. And I just thought that was great. I thought that's just such a great story of, feeling so empowered. I thought, great, I would love to put you on the phone with them. Just feeling so empowered and wanting to be the one to speak with them directly. And just hearing from our national staff there about, how at the start of this program, all of these women were really quiet and weren't speaking up. And it was really difficult to get anything out of them to a point at which they're saying, put me on the phone with the Canadian government so I can tell them what I think. So I mean, that was great. That just really spoke to, having, that sense of empowerment. And the confidence, yeah. And then most recently on the trip to South Sudan, we were working there before the conflict. And then when the conflict broke out in December 2013, we had to sort of scale down operations for a few months. But we were one of the first organizations to get up and running in the displaced persons camp in Upper Nile State. And so just being up there, I'd been up there before the conflict and going back up now and seeing what a change there'd been in the town. But to be in the camp and be working with people who were saying more of War Child's programming is needed. This is making such a difference. You're the only ones operating this school here that our children can go to. You really realize that importance of being there, throughout with the community. And they really saw that. We had staff there almost the whole time with them. We got up and running really quickly after the conflict with education programming for their kids. And to just see, them really trying to keep their kids in school through this conflict and wanting more classrooms built and wanting more teachers trained so that more kids can come in, was really, really great as well.
Do you see other groups there? Do you recognize other humanitarian, groups or charities that are working there and think, wow, like, if only, they did this or that? Do you see things like that?
I mean, in every country that we're in, there's always a great team of local organizations, and there is a lot of coordination between aid and development agencies as well. As far as sort of who's doing what, it's all, through the cluster system, we're able to keep track of who's doing what, make sure, as much as possible, we're not duplicating efforts, we're complementing efforts. For example, the school that I was mentioning that we built in South Sudan, it needs a latrine next to it now. So we're working with partners who do latrine construction instead of doing it ourselves, to come in and see what NGOs are there. Who can come in and build that, because no one agency can do it in and of themselves. And so that level of coordination is really important. And it helps with referrals as well. We had some older learners in our accelerated learning program in South Sudan saying they were having trouble seeing the blackboard because they needed glasses. And so we knew what healthcare NGOs were there that we could send them to for that referral.
Okay. And is there a problem having to separate boys and girls? Do you have to do that? Is it something that Because I see a lot of pictures of little girls. I don't really see much of little boys. And I'm just wondering, where are they?
They're there. That might just be a coincidence in the photos that are there. In some countries, they need to be separated just as far as the sides of the classrooms go. You know, girls on one side, boys on the other. And in some contexts, we will run separate programs if that's what the community asks for. So it really just depends based on what the community asks for and what's appropriate culturally.
Okay. What about the children? Do you have any stories of the children gathering around you? Are they like, you know, the kids when you go to Peru or Mexico or someplace and, you know, looking for handouts, or are they different?
I don't think we've really been in a situation in the countries where they're coming up looking for handouts. It's more when you pull a camera out. You just want their
picture
taken.
Oh, do they? That's fine.
Yeah, but I more tend to just give them my camera and say, take your own pictures. So I did that on the recent trip to South Sudan. But yeah, it's pretty rare that we'll have kids come up to us and ask for stuff, in part because War Child's well known in the countries that we're in, so they know what we're doing. And they know that, you know, we trained their teachers or built their schools or helped their family with farming or, you know, something like that. So they're very aware of, you know, what our mandate is and what we're doing there already.
What kind of pictures do they take? What interests them?
For the most part, pictures of their friends.
Okay.
You know, and then they give the camera to their friends and they'll take pictures of each other and stuff. So it's more things like that, you know, than anything else. If it's around their house, they'll, you know, take pictures of stuff that might be outside their house, of some of their livestock, anything like that comes out. But pretty much the same thing would happen if you gave, you know, a 7 or 8 year old a camera here.
Sure. Sure. How much of I was thinking about these kids running around with these cameras. I just thought the culture within the camps. How many last one that you just came from last week? How many families are in that camp, the displaced persons camp?
I don't know about families in general. The current population is sitting at about 18,000.
Wow.
So I don't know. I mean, if you look at family size, anywhere between, say, 4 and 8 or 9 to a family, really depending, that would be, you know, sort of your family size. Yeah, it started out at about 21,000 and then recently has gone down to about 18,000, which is a good sign. It means people are leaving the camp, which is what you want. But the number's starting to go back up a bit as people who left the country because of the violence are coming back to the country, but they're coming back to the camp. So while people who stayed in the country in the camp are going back to the community, people who left the country are coming back to the camp.
What kind of diseases are running rampant in the camps? Anything?
Not a healthcare expert, but some of the stuff that we heard about was definitely malaria in the rainy season becomes an issue. I think in some of the camps, not the one we're in, they've had a couple of outbreaks of cholera. So that was a bit of an issue. Yeah, I don't know the rest off the top of my head.
Were you affected by Ebola at all in any of the countries?
No, we don't. We used to work in West Africa, but we don't anymore. And so it wasn't in any of the countries that we were in.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. What kind of foods do they eat in the Sudan? Like, do they have a national dish, or what do you eat when you're there?
A lot of rice. As far as what they were eating in the camps, I think there was some food distribution going on. So you're looking at like sorghum and rice and that type of thing. As far as national dishes, off the top of my head, I don't know. I know a lot of, you know, kitchen vegetables are grown. And then I think sorghum is a main crop. Maize, rice is widely eaten. I don't think it's a huge crop there. That type of thing are more of the staple foods that you're looking at.
Yeah,
a little bit more. I mean, you do end up with more food distribution programs in the camps because of the conflict, they missed planting season last year. So there's a lot more reliance on food aid than there was previously.
How much do they know about North America? Do they try to emulate things or, you know, ask you about, music or rock stars or anything fashion?
Yeah, I mean, It's interesting, though, sort of what makes its way over to some of the countries.
Yeah,
In Afghanistan, Rihanna and Shakira are really popular. It's, you know, one of those things. Okay, well, that's it's just interesting what makes it. And then Celine Dion in sub-Saharan Africa is huge. And when they find out you're Canadian, you always get this whole like, oh, Canadian, you love Celine Dion. But she's, for as long as I've been going back and forth, and you know, I lived in West Africa for a short while. Celine has been pretty much at the top of the list.
Did she go
as
there?
Far as like popularity? I don't know that she's ever been there. And I don't know if it's
so
in part
amazing.
That she sings in English and French or whatever, but yeah, really, really popular. So there's that
what
kind
if
of
she knows that?
Yeah, I don't. It is one of those things that you do wonder sometimes. But she's very popular. And then we actually did get to talking a lot in South Sudan about the peace process that was going on in Addis at the time. And, you know, the youth in the camp especially being very aware of what was going on, and actually asked how, you know, what Canada's role in it was, which is very minimal. And then if I felt that Canada had failed them, which was a very interesting and difficult question to answer. But, you know, I think the internet and social media and mobile phones and all this has really opened up the world, as we know. And so you do have a youth community in all of the countries in which we work who are very engaged, not only in the pop culture and celebrity aspects of it, but also in sort of the global issues that are going on right now.
Wow, that's amazing. You you think, do they have internet? Like, anybody walking around with iPads? We're so just hooked up here, and I know that. Yeah, wow, Celine Dion. Who would have thought? So War Child sets up like teacher training. So it's not just teaching, but you're also teaching local people how to be teachers over there. And you've got these peer education clubs. What are those all about?
Yeah, so the teacher training, yeah, as you said, is a really key element of it as far as contributing to the quality of education that youth are getting. And then peer education clubs was something we were running in Sierra Leone, and we have something a little bit similar in some of the other countries that we're in. But it's really just for youth more at the high school level to offer peer support, sort of
okay.
how you'd see here, kind of informal tutoring
sure.
sometimes. You know, you have someone who's good at math helping someone who needs support in that and making sure that you really have the support that they need, which, you know, and we know in every country is sometimes at that peer level, you know, peers are just able to relate to each other in a different and sometimes a more productive way than a formal teaching environment.
Right.
So just making sure that we create that space and those mechanisms for youth to be able to have that to make sure that they're really succeeding in their school.
Now, I also read that War Child, elders from Darfur credited War Child Canada with opening dialogue between conflicting tribes in the region.
Yeah, so we also do a lot of, oh, so go ahead.
Yeah, no, which tribes would those be? Would it be like Shiites and Muslims, or I don't know who's there, but...
Yeah, no, it's more just local tribes
okay.
that you might have who might be fighting on something over rangeland or pasture land or, you know, we want to use this land to farm, but this is the land we have, you know, our cows graze on type of thing. Or it can be a more, like a longer running conflict that, you know, is maybe more generational and has its roots a little bit further back.
Right.
And so a lot of the work we do, not just in Sudan, but in some other countries as well, is focused on youth development and peace building through a youth-to-youth methodology. So it's basically working with youth on basic life skills, which can be, you know, health and hygiene, communication for peace, you know, all of that type of thing, and then having them assess different issues in their community. And it could be, you know, issues around conflict. It could be issues around sexual and gender-based violence. It could be issues around child protection, you know, what have you, and looking at the root causes of those and looking at what they as a youth group can do to address that through small projects. So we had youth in Afghanistan do projects on youth drug abuse. We've had youth in Darfur organize sports tournaments amongst different tribes to bring them together in a recreational activity. We've had youth organize community cleanup days, lead the development of rangeland management plans, basically any of these youth-driven community projects that can help the community address a community-identified issue.
I read that somebody just donated an enormous sum of money in February to War Child Canada. The Slate Family Foundation has promised.
Yeah, they did. They've been a great supporter of ours.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
No, $1 million. $1 million.
Oh, okay.
It was.
Okay.
I think it was $7 million total to a number of charities, and $1 million was promised to us.
What? That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, no, they've been a great supporter of ours for a really long time, and we've really appreciated their support. They've been really great.
I love it. So they're not slowing down anyway. That's good.
No, we're growing and expanding right now.
It was interesting to read Brock Warner's posting. It was called The Good and the Bad Side by Side, and how it's illegal to take photos of government buildings and employees in the South Sudan. That's interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
It's not just in South Sudan. It's actually in a number of conflict-affected countries, in part because they're just worried about, you know, those photos being out there as things that could be potential targets. So, government buildings, bridges, anything that could be a target for an opposition force, they really don't want you taking a picture of it. So it is in South Sudan, but we do see it in a number of countries that were in, airports. You can't take pictures at airports, all of this type of thing, which is, a security measure for the country. We work in, and is understandable given, the situation that they're in and that they're trying to guarantee their own nation's security.
Yeah. I have to say, I love the video. Did your office make that video, The Power of Childhood?
The one that's on the website?
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, we have great agencies that we work with who produce that for us. It's a very powerful video, I think. The first time we all saw it, it's sort of like, oh, wow, it's just really, really powerful. And for those who haven't seen it, you can just go to warchild.ca and it's, right there. But yeah, no, that's a great, really great video.
So we have War Child Canada, London, Holland, different places. Are you connected? Are you separate entities? How do you work with one another, or do you?
Yeah, we do. So there's the three War Childs, as you mentioned. There's us, there's one in the UK, and there's one in Holland. And we are three legally separate entities. So we have separate boards of directors, we're separately registered, but we coordinate very closely together. So for example, in South Sudan, we share an office space in Juba. And share, a lot of coordination. We have a joint program that we implement with them, the vocational training one I mentioned before. They're doing a child protection component of that, so it's a joint program that we have. And so in a lot of the countries, you'll see that where it's shared office space, shared programming, shared resources, like as much as we can do to just complement each other's work and work really closely together. Because at the end of the day, we're all working towards the same mission and the same mandate, and obviously have the same name. So where we are in the same countries, there is a lot of close coordination.
So it was started in Canada by Samantha, but were they started there too, or did one country start it and the others followed, or?
I'm not an expert on the history of it, but I actually think War Child Holland was the first one. I think War Child Holland was the first one, and then the other ones came after that. So there is that sort of shared branding, shared mission, and all of that, but they weren't, all created at the same time, and Canada was definitely not the first one, although we have been around for about 13 or 14 years now.
Okay. I can't remember if it was the last show or show before that. There was an organization I had found that monitors all the countries who are at civil war with one another, and many of the countries obviously that you work in have gone through that, and genocide and all kinds of horrific things. What's the worst time that you've been in, or scariest time that you've actually go, oh my gosh, like I don't know if I want to do this anymore? Have you ever got to that point, or?
I don't think I've ever gotten to that point. No, I don't think I've ever gotten to that point. You're definitely, in situations sometimes where, you're thinking, okay, like you sort of look back on it sometimes, like, all right, well, that was, maybe a little bit scarier than I realized at the time. But fortunately, there's that sort of, sorry?
I said sometimes ignorance is bliss. You know, you get yourself into it.
Yeah, and sometimes things just happen really quickly as well.
Yeah.
You know, but fortunately, you know, as I was saying earlier, with War Child's, you know, very stringent safety and security policies, I've never been in, you know, a really hairy situation or any situation that made me say, you know, oh, I don't want to go back to that country, or I don't want to go back, you know, to that environment or to that community. And I think in part that is because we have really strong community buy-in in the areas that we're in.
Okay.
And so, you know, they know why we're there. They know what we're doing. And so once you're there in some of those communities, there is a lot of support for the work that you're doing. And, you know, they really understand why you're there. So you feel really supported by the local community, which is, you know, very helpful.
Yeah, well, that's good. You know, I know for myself, you know, in North America, we're not used to having guns pointed at us and people walking around with machine guns and Uzis and whatnot. And last Christmas, I was in Mexico and we were on the ocean, and a militia boat came up to us and their faces were covered and they had guns and they came on a fishing boat. And really, it was just to make sure we all had life vests on. But of course, there's, you know, rapid in Spanish what's going on? Why aren't they showing their faces? Why are they all covered? And it was like the local police. And it's scary, you know, it's scary to have machine guns and faces that are masked and pointed at you. So
yeah, that's,
you know,
really scary.
Something that we're used to. And I imagine you see a lot more of that when you're overseas. Because I'm sure that
do.
Lots of guards walking around with guns, so it becomes a little more commonplace.
Yeah, and it's a little bit more commonplace. In part, just being in conflict-affected countries, there's naturally just, you know, army personnel around and armed security personnel and all of that kind of thing. So I'm not sure you ever fully get used to it, but I think it also doesn't become shocking. You know, you just get off a plane and you look around and you remind yourself that, you know, of the context that you're in, and there are going to be armed people, and then you kind of go on, and it's not, you know, then at that point, every time you see someone, it's not sort of that shocking, like, oh my goodness, there's a man behind me with an AK-47. You know, you do sort of adapt to the context a little bit more.
Yeah, you're like, do you know how to use that thing? Or yeah. It's pretty scary. You know what I really love about War Child? I love the loans. I love the idea of women getting loans and making sure that other women don't default on them and just really supporting one another. I just think that's brilliant.
Yeah, the group-based loans that we do in Afghanistan, that's going back to the economic development programming. Yeah, so it's a way, I mean, there's a lot of different ways of doing microfinance, which I think sometimes people don't always know, that there's a lot of different models out there of different ways that you can do it. And so we really chose the group-based approach, in part because then women can offer each other peer support, you know, and they come together in groups that we call village organizations, and just get that peer support for business development and maybe challenges they're facing their family. But then, yeah, with loans given out in that structure, the women guarantee each other's loans. And so we did have a zero default rate. We had some women who paid it back late, you know, because something came up with the family and they needed the money for that. But if you do have a woman who misses a payment, you know, the other women will go and say, hey, where are you? What's going on? And, you know, so it really is a peer support system for it, and, you know, really worked well in the context that we were in.
Now, the number I have is 700 women received this training with like 98% successfully operating small businesses. What kind of money are we talking about went out? Do you have any numbers?
As far as the size of the microfinance loans or what they're making each
month? Yeah, like no. Like how much in money actually went out to these women, the 700 women, let's say?
I think the loans were around $300 or $350 US, the initial loan. So they went through a series of loans. So once they paid back the first, they could get a second. Once they paid back the second, they could get a third. But I think those first ones were around $300, $350 US. And then the women were able, by the end of the project, were contributing about 25% of their household income each month, up from pretty much zero contribution each month.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. No, it was great.
And what kind of businesses would they go into?
It was whatever they were trained on vocationally. We had done market assessments that showed that food processing, beautification, and tailoring were the three main ones. So the women chose what they wanted to go into on that. And so beautification is essentially like, think of like a hairdressing shop combined with makeup application.
Right.
And so those were really popular.
You know, I remember years and, you know, eons ago, I used to work as a makeup artist. And I remember they saying that times of war, it doesn't matter, women will always find the money. for makeup. There's always time for beauty and money for beauty. And here you are living in a, you know, in a camp or in a country that's, and you have no money, but you're going to get beautiful. I love
it. Yeah, I think it's one of those important things as far as, you know, I used to be on the board of directors for an organization that worked on the downtown east side of Vancouver. And we worked with, you know, very vulnerable and at-risk women to provide them with the clothes that they needed, business clothes, to go to job interviews. And then with haircuts and makeup application and all of that type of thing. And I think we all know that, you know, it's that when you feel good about yourself,
yes,
you know, that can be a first step in that psychosocial support
as
well. Feeling good, feeling you're able to maintain your dignity, which is such an important thing, and then being able to, you know, go into other things. But it is, you know, such a key element sometimes and in some context of that psychosocial element that can be taken away at times in times of conflict.
Right. No, I you know, I wholeheartedly support it. I think it's very important. I was in a really bad accident a number of years ago and very depressed. And they sent me to see the psychiatrist and he goes, well, you're not depressed. You have makeup on. I'm like, okay, good one. That's funny. That's very funny.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, sometimes, you know, you don't want to look in the mirror and see what you can see. But I thought that's somebody who's really not in touch. But yeah, no, that's great. And you sent me this picture of this woman who was operating her own little restaurant, and it's great. I love it. It's just so great to see.
They have that spirit. Just have the chance to be on the ground and talk to these women and see the businesses that they're running and the difference that it makes in their children's lives. You know, that the women are able to contribute to or provide all of the household income, and then use that money to support the family, to send the child to school, to buy basic necessities, you know, all of that kind of thing.
And with the women who are getting loans, do they have to be single or could they have a husband?
No, it's absolutely not dependent on marital status.
Okay.
It was really, as far as selecting the women, looking at the most vulnerable women. So that could be a female-headed household where, you know, perhaps they didn't have a husband or the husband had passed away, women who were in really low economic status, you know, any number of vulnerability criteria. But it was not dependent in any way on that.
Wow. Nikki, you're doing an amazing job out there.
Well,
what do you hope to see in your future for War Child?
Well, you know, War Child is expanding right now, and so I think that's just a really important step for us. We're focusing a lot on the Middle East at the moment, working with the Syrian refugee crisis in Jordan and Lebanon and looking at some other countries. Long-term for War Child, I think we would all say we'd love to see a world where we're not needed, you know, where children's lives are no longer affected by conflict. But for the moment, you know, the focus that we have on making sure that childhood isn't lost in conflict, I think is so important. Important in being able to reach as many children as we can with that.
So War Child was started in 1999, my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to call them superstars for lack of a better word. Did any of these children come out and be superstars? Is there somebody that said, wow, you know what, War Child did this and look at them today? Can you think of anybody like
yeah.
that?
I'm sure there are. To be honest, we don't track sort of that long term. Some of the countries that we're in, that we were in, we're not in any longer. You know, we've done programming in Georgia, Haiti, Sierra Leone, Iraq, you know, a bunch of different countries. And so those first countries that we were in a long time ago, where those children will now be adults, you know, because we're no longer there, it is hard to track those children. But we do have children who've gone through our education programs and gone on to be, you know, life skills facilitators with us or community volunteers with us, you know, those type of examples.
I'm sure that a lot of them give back. I did a show with one of the Lost Boys who was one of the fortunate ones to be able to come to Michigan and go to Michigan University, you know, grew up with a family here and became a healthcare provider and then went back to Sudan to open up a healthcare facility because his family had to walk I think 7 hours to get to the nearest facility. You know, you're not going to do that if you're having a baby. So I love that they have this idea, I'm going to go back and do this. And I'm sure that so many of the people that you're helping are thinking, you know, are staying and helping because they can.
Yeah, we definitely see that with the women that we've worked with. We're bringing on mentors. So the women that we trained in vocational training, we're then bringing on younger women and training them themselves, sort of unbeknownst to us. And then we found out about it and thought, well, that's great. What can we do to support you in this? There was definitely sort of that, the continuity of the programming happening.
We've been talking to Nikki Waits. She's the Deputy Director for War Child Canada. We got a couple seconds left. Nikki, how can we help if we want to help?
If you want to learn more about War Child or would love to donate, our website's warchild.ca, so you can go on there and learn more about our programming and how you can get involved. Another way to help just more generally is for people to spread information in their communities about, you know, what's going on internationally and see how the community might want to get involved, whether it's doing a small fundraiser or, again, just spreading that awareness even more broadly, because the more people that are aware, the more difference that you can make as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being my guest today. I really enjoyed speaking to you and hearing all about War Child.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Amazing operation. Take care. Have yourself
Thank
a great
you.
Day.
All right. Thanks.
Bye
now.